Well, holy buckets, what a topic, truth. Oh. Okay, so a story from my, a story first. The story is by my about my oldest brother, Michael. And he told this to me, and he's a Unitarian Universalist too, out in Northeast Wisconsin. Now, Mike was talking with my dad about my thinking about going into the ministry. And Dad's response was, all ministers are crooks. They're mean and dishonest, and they all tell lies. And Mike said, Dad, now Susie's not a crook. And Dad's, you have to agree with that. So yeah, Dad. And she isn't mean or dishonest. Well, you know, usually not. And so my brother said, so when Susie becomes a minister, at least there'll be one minister who tells the truth. Ah, just a ringing endorsement. So here I am, trying to tell you about, and I can't, you know, the truth, big T, I don't think so. More realistically, which of course also means more truly, I'll offer my thoughts on where truth, or at least my truth, lies. And I was talking with a preacher's kid, a PK, as they're known in the biz, who I was talking about this service, and I said, yeah, I have 3 points, you know, philosophy, and I can remember this, science, and creativity, poetry. She said, yeah, every sermon ought to have 3 points and then a conclusion. So I start with the philosopher's stone. Now, I got into the practical side of philosophy. I have a master's in philosophy with an emphasis on practical ethics. I got into ethics, how we ought to live in this world. Now, during that almost two and a half years of study, I took classes in feminist ethics, in medical, environmental, professional ethics, technology and ethics, legal ethics, you know, our laws, but catch the music of truth's eternal chime. I learned the difference between the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. And in my course of study, we focused on just a handful of philosophers and their idea about ways to live. Now, first we started with Aristotle. And his golden mean, you know, his idea that that there is a desirable middle between excess and deficiency. So when you talk about bravery as a virtue, you don't want to be overly brave as to be reckless and, you know, break your neck, you know, snowboarding across wherever. Neither do you want to be cowardly, but there is a way to take all of the virtues and practice them to the right extent, at the right moment, with the right person, at the right time. You know, and Aristotle says, yeah, that takes a lifetime to learn, so good luck. Okay, that's Aristotle. Okay, that's that class. And in the Hebrew Bible, in Ecclesiastes, the preacher admonishes his audience to be not righteous overmuch. Do not make yourself overwise. Be not overmuch wicked, neither be a fool. So just wise enough. Just talking about your truth enough and not to be self-righteous. Just canny enough that you're not taken in. Follow the middle way. So next we got to Immanuel Kant. He of the categorical imperative and duty ethics. Well, Kant, bless his heart, goes on and on. But his really important nugget for me is how we ought to treat people. How we ought to treat people as ends, not means. And by that he means that we don't use people for our own ends. That we treat everyone with their inherent worth and dignity. Just a lovely idea. And then we went to John Stuart Mill. He's mostly associated with utilitarianism, the greatest good for the greatest number. But the quote that always stuck in my head was his idea of happiness and pleasure. And he had this thing that he reportedly said, it is better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied. And so certainly the nugget for me is happiness and the pursuit of happiness, which is a big thing, of course, in the U.S. Constitution. The pursuit of happiness. What kind of happiness is that? That's not the happiness of a pig having more slop than anybody else. That's the happiness of learning about the world and about yourself and using all that you were given to be a full human being. So we went to feminist ethics, who focus on circles of relationships. And the best of them, I think, emphasize the need to not lose oneself, one's own goals and interests, while maintaining relationships. But that relationships are important. And you make your decisions based upon the group. And finally, communal ethicists. And for this sort of ethics, we read indigenous literature. And the balance between our responsibilities towards the community and how the community upholds us and our individual goals. So that's it. You got 2.5 years of a degree. The philosophers I studied, their search for truth, a way to live truly, authentically, fully, and those were the bits of truth that stood out for me. Of course, to start this section off, my God, you got to read a lot of stuff to get the truth. So what I went to, of course, was Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, and I reread it. Of course, I had to find it here because in the States it's called the Sorcerer's Stone, and I have the Hufflepuff version. So it's the gold and black version. Apparently, you can get each. There are four houses in the Wizardry School of Hogwarts, and so this version tells you a little bit about the founder and their regalia and all of that stuff. Of course, in Harry Potter, the Philosopher's Stone is ultimately destroyed. The Philosopher's Stone was an actual stone that could turn anything you wanted it to turn into gold and provide you with immortality. And it's a foolish truth to follow, you know. So it was destroyed in the end. Some good truths in Harry Potter. Well, next I went to the scientist's view, the scientist's North Star. And recently I was introduced at one of the other churches I preach at by this book called We Have No Idea, A Guide to the Unknown Universe. Now, it's written by two men. One is a cartoonist who puts out PhD comics. They're also known as Piled Higher and Deeper. Any of you who have a PhD know they're Piled Higher and Deeper comics. His PhD is actually in robotics, and he works at Stanford, which is a very prestigious university in the States. And the other person who wrote it is a professor of experimental particle physics at another California university and also conducts research with the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. So these guys know of what they speak. So what is the truth of science, or at least of physics in our physical world? Scientists use the scientific method. They observe, they measure, they experiment, they formulate hypotheses, they test again, they modify the hypotheses, and if it keeps on coming out the same results, then you have gotten truthier, to use one of the contemporary words. So, these folks, at the very beginning of the book, say that the tests that we have reveal that our universe is roughly made up of a combination of regular matter, us, the chairs, this building, the trees, the sky, all of that stuff. 5% regular matter, dark matter, 27%, and dark energy, 68%. And they tell us, even though we don't know what each of these things are, we can say with fairly good confidence that we know how much of them there is. We have no idea what some of them are, but we know that they are there. Welcome to the era of precision ignorance. And, of course, the cartoonist has this little cartoon at the very, very beginning, a pie chart, of course, a circle with a little piece of the pie, the 5%, that is labeled everything we know, everything we see, all the atoms in your body and in our galaxy, all the stars and dust and planets within and outside of our solar system. The other 95%, colored gray, says, no freaking idea. So, now, I'm not all the way through this book. But what I did learn is that what I had learned as protons and neutrons are now considered to be composed of up quarks and down quarks. Okay, so I have a vague idea of that. Electrons, bless their heart, they are still electrons. The dark matter, that 27% has mass, but is invisible. It moves regularly through regular matter, and it usually hangs out in galaxies. And that dark energy, that 67% of everything, comes from the energy, they think, of empty space, of space that's got nothing in it, but there's energy, and it may somehow be pushing the universe outward. Now, on page 41 of a 340-page book, the authors conclude, we know that there are powerful forces out there beyond our comprehension and that we have much to learn about the universe. Yeah, me too. When I was researching this, and oh my goodness, yeah, you find truth or truthiness, depending, in Google, it happened to be the anniversary, the 97th anniversary of the birth of this woman, Olga Alexandrovna Ladyshenskaya. She was a Russian mathematician who is known for her work in partial differential equations. The picture on Google showed her with this, to me, utterly incomprehensible scientific formula. So in the biz, in mathematics, partial differential equations are called PDEs, different than public displays of affection, PDAs. PDEs contain unknown, they're good for describing some phenomena that have lots of different variables. So they're used to describe a lot of how our world works. Sound, heat, diffusion, electrostatics, fluid dynamics, elasticity, and quantum mechanics. Now, I'm not a theoretical philosopher. I am a practical philosopher, and I'm certainly not a theoretical scientist. I can balance my checkbook. I got A's in all of my science and math classes, but a lot of them didn't make sense to me. But a biological sciences did. As an old registered nurse from way back, I know some anatomy and physiology, I know lab values, I know what a healthy body is supposed to look like and feel like and sound like. New truths about the body and how the mind works, those are accessible, understandable, exciting truths for me, and theoretical science, not so much. But scientists in whatever field they are, and I Googled this too, who knew? There were so many fields of science. Mathematics, pure applied, statistics and probability, computer and information sciences, physical science, chemical science, earth and related environmental sciences, and biological sciences. In one other scheme, they also included interdisciplinary science, applied science, like engineering, social science, and philosophy history. How fascinating as a science. But scientists in whatever field try to more precisely, more truthfully figure out how the world and each of its pieces works, whether it's the ocean or the weather or the rocks and geology, the water, our bodies, our minds, our separate pieces of our bodies. They give us understanding truths that at times in our history have led us out of fear, out of falsehoods, out of superstition. We're always trying to get truer truths about how the world works and how we work in it. Though I understand only a fraction of what science tells me, I am so grateful for those folks and their truths and their search for truths, their continued search. They continue, these scientists too. I of course, like so often in my mystery books, I've read the last chapter already. I read how it turns out, you know. And they're excited. They're excited about how much we don't know and how much we can still learn about how the world works, the verifiable, truth-filled facts of life. And finally, I've muddled and fiddled in other areas in English literature, in theology. I have a Master of Divinity, so of course I can talk for an hour about divinity. Holy buckets. And another way we learn truths, scientific truths, do not and quite possibly cannot explain questions of, like, why does the universe exist? All those why, mommy, why, daddy questions that we keep asking and never get the precise answers to. So art, the creative process, I've learned through my decades of reading that some art grabs us, speaks to us, it illuminates life for us. And I learned this, when I finally once again picked up a Jane Austen when I was in my mid-40s and thought, well, this is really rather quite good, because I didn't understand a bit of it when I tried it when I was 20. Some poems, they're okay. Or they're and some poems are like sunshine, lighting up some area of life. And it's different for all of us, that those artistic truths are different for all of us. They're another way to feed our spirit of inquiry. There are stories and myths that speak to us, music, different kinds of music, different kinds of visual art, and the activities that bring us joy, deep joy, and help us learn about the world. Whether that's nature or relationships, working together in this congregation, lofty ideals like justice and truth and kindness, psychological, emotional, creative truths are magnitudes squishier than our scientific understanding of ourselves and our world. That's my truth, and you may read it differently, but. And the arts may not be speaking to you, but for me, a poem from one of my favorite poets who just died recently, Mary Oliver. My work is loving the world. Here the sunflowers, there the hummingbird, equal seekers of sweetness. Here the quickening yeast, there the blue plums. Hear the clam deep in the speckled sand. Are my boots old? Is my coat torn? Am I wearing this third-hand dress? Am I no longer young and still not half perfect? Let me keep my mind on what matters, which is my work, which is mostly standing still and learning to be astonished. The Phoebe, the delphinium, the sheep in the pasture, and the pasture, which is mostly rejoicing, since all ingredients are here, which is gratitude, to be given a mind and a heart and these body clothes, a mouth with which to give shouts of joy to the moth and to the wren and to the sleepy dug-up clam, telling them all over and over how it is that we live forever. So these things, these people, this movement in the world is a different sort of truth. You know, sunflowers and blue plums reveal the sweetness, these ingredients, what matters to be grateful, though no longer young and not half perfect. How did that happen? You know, oh, my work is loving the world. So there you got it. Philosophy, science, the arts. So some closing thoughts. For years when I attended our national Unitarian Universalist conferences down in the States, in the exhibit hall, there was always a man who had a booth, who had a Bible, who challenged anybody to go to any page in that Bible, and every page of that Bible contained a falsehood. And, well, now, in my search for truth, I read another little book called Aristotle and an Aardvark, Go to Washington, Understanding Political Doublespeak. And so, from that, I understand that saying that every page in the Bible has a falsehood is really a straw man argument. It's just too easy an argument to win. My goodness, I could probably do almost the same thing with Aristotle and any of his scientific notions. As my philosophy mentor would say, you know, that's what sophomores do, is argue with everything and say, oh, that's false, that's false. You people are graduate students, you find that nugget of truth in there. There's a reason why Aristotle and Kant and Mill, the feminist ethicists, the indigenous wisdom, art, have persisted. There's truth there. There's truth there. So, here are a couple of passages from the Bible, and which do ring true for me, and one reflection from a Baptist minister. From the Christian Bible in Philippians chapter 4, verse 8. Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is gracious, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. And then the Reverend Gordon Atkinson, in his essay, The Truths of the Bible, writes, people know that the Bible is not a self-help book full of easy answers, but a book of stories and wisdom that is meant to lead us into relationship and worship. And by worship, if I gave you that quiz today, most of you could get it. Shaping worth, talking about things that matter in our deeper lives. Now, there are hard and fast truths in the Bible, yes, but they are surrounded by soft truths and slippery truths and sometimes truths and truths that once were true but are no longer true and truths that are only true if you are in the right state of mind and truths that are only true if you are not hurting someone and truths that are true in the moment but not if you are talking about the moment and truths that only can be lived and should never be spoken. And truths that we cannot hear, and truths that are more than we can bear. Reverend Atkinson. And finally, from the Hebrew Bible, the prophet Micah. He has showed you what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, and to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. And by God, I mean that most expansive idea of where your loyalties and your time and your energy lie. And that may be with your garden, and that may be with your family, and that may be with the political process, or going to the soup kitchen, it may be with nature. But you walk humbly there. To do justice, to love kindness, to walk humbly with your God, with your God. To do justice, to love kindness, to walk humbly with your God, with your God. To fall in love, oh, to not let go. To not stand above, to not stand below. To do justice, to love kindness, to walk humbly, to walk lightly on this earth. And for those of you who have been in other services, you know I get truth from comics all the time. Classic Peanuts. Here's Peppermint Patty and Charlie Brown. They're leaning against a tree. Peppermint Patty on one side, Charlie Brown on the other. Peppermint Patty says, I'm worried about you, Charles. Or no, she calls him Chuck. Chuck, about me, Charlie Brown says. And Peppermint Patty says, yes, I'm worried that you're living too much in the past. You haven't seen that little red-haired girl for over a year, and you keep talking about her. Maybe, Charlie Brown says, I'm living in the future. Maybe that's what we call hope. Or maybe I'm just too wishy-washy to forget her. And Peppermint Patty says, I don't know, Chuck. I just hate to see you always living in the past. Of course, I'd hate to see you only living in the future, too. Maybe, as they always say, the truth lies somewhere in between. Buddhist truth. In the moment. So may it be so. May we make it so. Blessed be, and amen.